let's keep her in prayer. Tell her we're thinking of her. Okay, let's do just a little bit of review tonight in the book of Revelation. I think it's good for us to go back and sort of see where we are. I try to keep before us the idea of it being apocalyptic literature and that a lot of it is from the standpoint of a drama or showing a whole scene that John sees. We looked at the seven churches in particular in chapters 2 and 3. We saw emphasis of God on his throne in chapter 4, that he is deserving of praise and that he's still in charge. In chapter 5, we saw Christ called the Lamb, also called the Lion, but called the Lamb in connection with the opportunity to open the little book that was sealed. The book was sealed with seven seals, and we talked about how a book would be sealed or a document would be sealed. And then when we get on over a little further, we have the sealing of the saints, and the word seal is used in two different ways in these two areas. The book was sealed in that there was something that kept it from being opened. And the saints were sealed in that that God pointed out who his saints were. Figuratively, they've given the seal in the forehead, which is in contrast with the mark of the beast that will be referred to later in the book of Revelation that marked those who did worship the emperor. And you know, I got to thinking today, in thinking about these seals on this book, I said something last week, I guess it was, that maybe we didn't know for sure whether there were seven seals that sealed all of it, or whether it was different. And you get to thinking about it, the seals were opened one at a time, weren't they? So it must have been, in this scene, a section of the book that was sealed with the first seal, and he opened it, and that was revealed. And then a second seal was opened, and something else was opened, and that was revealed. That seems to be the idea that is presented there. Now, let me also remind you, we've mentioned this, there were the seven seals, and then after that there will be the seven trumpets. And after that there will be the seven bowls of wrath, or vials, as it's translated in some instances. And generally speaking, when these sevens are given, the first four are mentioned somewhat together. Then the fifth and sixth are mentioned a little bit, and usually a little bit different way from the first four. And then the seventh seal usually is the transition into the next seven. When we open the seventh seal, it will reveal what? The seven trumpets. And that seems to be sort of a pattern. In the sixth chapter, the Lamb opened one of the seals, and there was a white horse. And then the second seal, there was a red horse. Third seal, there was a black horse. Fourth seal, there was a pale horse. And we discussed that as suggesting the things over which Rome had no control, but God did have control and would use these to help to overcome the persecution that was being done. Probably referring to military conquest with the first horse, war with the second horse, famine with the third horse, and death and Hades with the fourth horse. And then when the fifth seal was opened, what did that reveal? It was different from the first four, wasn't it? It revealed the martyrs, didn't it? The souls that had died, and where they were, the idea of protection. And then the sixth seal, along about verse 12 of chapter 6, comes back with the earthquake, which is sort of an expansion or a magnification of the first four, what would happen to the ones on earth, and what part of the earth was going to be affected by that which was revealed by the seals. Now that's with the next one. What was the first one? Look at chapter 6 and verse 8. All power is given unto them over the fourth part of the earth. Now when we get over to chapter 8 and verse 7, with the revelation of the trumpets beginning, it's going to be a third part of the earth. And it seems to me that what he's doing with these scenes is showing that it's going to get what? Worse and worse until he accomplishes what he wants to accomplish. After chapter 6 gives us the first six seals, the first four with the horses, the fifth showing where the souls of the saints are, the sixth describing the earthquake and the destruction with it. Chapter 7 is what we call an interlude. And just in looking to get this in proper focus, notice that the first six seals are in chapter 6. When is the seventh seal opened? Chapter 8, verse 1. So you've got the seventh chapter between the sixth seal and the seventh seal. And we discussed from the standpoint that probably that's to reassure the saints and that God has them in mind and will take care of their needs. Because where was this destruction going to take place? Where were all these things going to happen? In the area where they lived. And so if all this was going to happen around you, wouldn't you have the question, what about me? What's going to happen to us? And the seventh chapter is basically for that reason, with the interlude giving the sealing of the saints. He says, before we reveal this seventh seal, and before this happens, in fact, in the first part of chapter 7, there were the four angels ready, but he says, do what? Wait. Wait until we seal the saints. And that was not a literal seal that was put on the forehead of the saints, but it was some way to identify those that were the followers of God, whereas the mark of the beast later on seemed to be used to identify those who were the follower of the emperor and persecuting the church. In verse 3 of chapter 7, till we have sealed the servants of our God in their foreheads. And I heard the number of them which were sealed, and there were sealed 144,000. And then he gives the 12 tribes, 12,000 of each. And then in verse 9, he says, after this, after he's mentioned the 144,000 and the 12 times 12, after this, and lo, a great multitude, which no man could number of all nations and kindreds and people and tongues, stood before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed with white robes and palms in their hands. Some think that the great multitude in verse 9 is restating the 144,000 in the verses just before that, emphasizing a great number. But if you look closely, the 144,000 were where? On earth or heaven? He says, we're going to put the seals in the forehead of the saints. They were the ones that were still living, weren't they? Look closely at verse 9. After this I beheld, and lo, a great multitude, which no man could number of all nations and kindreds and people and tongues, stood before the throne and before the Lamb. Where did we find the throne and the Lamb in chapters 4 and 5? In heaven. And with that fifth seal, where were the souls? They were in God's keeping, weren't they? I'm not trying to identify exactly what the place was where they were. It said they were under the altar of God, which indicates that they had not been avenged yet, because you remember they asked what question? How long, O Lord, until our blood is avenged? I think the significance of the large numbers in chapter 7 is to say that whether you are alive or whether you're already dead, who's going to protect you? God is. And that's not unlike some of the other books. The book of 1 Thessalonians was probably written for the main purpose of answering a misconception that the Christians at Thessalonica had. Studying that entire book and putting it in context, it seems that the Christians at Thessalonica thought that the Lord was going to come before too long, and that those who died and went on would not receive the benefits of those who were alive when the Lord returned. You remember that passage in 1 Thessalonians 4 that says that the dead in Christ shall rise first, then they which are alive and remain shall be caught up together. And a lot of 1 Thessalonians was written to show that even if a Christian dies and goes on, that he will receive his reward just as much as the one who's alive. And I think that's the concept of, to some extent here in Revelation 7, that he's saying, with all this that's happening, you need to understand that God is still in charge and that he'll take care of those that are his. John, you have a comment? I think they understood it better after they read this in Revelation. I suspect with all the persecution that was going on that they were wondering what's going to happen to us in life and what's going to happen to us after death. And if you take that whole sixth chapter, the first four seals and the sixth seals are basically talking about what he's going to do to those that are against the church, right? And the fifth seal is showing that he has those that have died in the Lord in protection. And if you're asking the question, did they understand that before Revelation was written to them? I don't know. I suspect that they may have been, as I said, like the church at Thessalonica and didn't have a complete understanding. And put yourself into the position of being persecuted like these Christians were, and wouldn't you have a question in mind of what's going to happen to me if I live and what's going to happen to me if I die?
And we'd feel better about the whole thing if we knew
that. And if we knew that. In fact, didn't we see a place there where God answered these that asked the question and said, not yet, because what's got to happen? There are going to be some others that will die and be just like you before all of this unfolds. And I think the main message is twofold in these chapters. He's saying God is in control enough to take care of those that are persecuting the church with the destruction. But he's also in charge of what? Those that are his, and will protect them. Another reason that I think the second number, the great multitude in verse 9 of chapter 7, may have to do with those that are in heaven. Go back to chapter 6, and after he describes those that have been slain for the word of God and are under the altar, the souls of them, he comes to verse 11 and says, white robes were given unto every one of them. And what's mentioned here in chapter 9? They were clothed with white robes and palms in their hand. And applying the principle that we've mentioned so many times, let's don't get bogged down with the specific applications and miss the main point. What he is emphasizing here, that if you are faithful to God, you don't really have anything to worry about. In fact, back in the second chapter is that statement, be thou faithful unto death. And what's the answer? I will give thee a crown of life. So that's the overall picture that he is showing. And he comes on down in 14 of chapter 7 and again mentions, these are they that had washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. They're before the throne of God and serve him day and night. That's almost got to be those that have already died, hasn't it? And whether that's not necessarily a literal concept, but he's saying they're in God's presence. And their presence there pays tribute to God as well as those that are on earth. They shall hunger no more, neither thirst any more. That's sort of like the last of Revelation. There'll be no pain, no tears, no heartaches, no trouble. For the Lamb which is in the midst of the throne shall feed them and shall lead them unto living fountains of water, and God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes. I don't know whether you'd ever thought of this or not, but most of the things that are attributed to the work of God, He works through someone else. But when it talks about wiping away the tears, what does it say? God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes, which, again, is of a figurative sense. Now, that's a pretty good review up through chapter 7, I think. And when we start with chapter 8, when He had opened the seventh seal, there was silence in heaven about the space of half an hour. Well, if it's the space of half an hour, what does that suggest? He said that they kept time. I'm not for sure that's what it suggests, but...
I don't know if their half hour is the same.
Well, when we look at places in the book of Revelation where it says 3.5 years, 42 months, 1,200 and so many days, that suggests a long period of time, doesn't it? The 30 minutes here, the half an hour, I think is intended to suggest for a short period of time. What does the silence mean other than what we've jokingly tried to make it mean tonight?
I know it says calm before the storm.
Okay. I think there's two things that it may suggest. It may be suggested to get their attention. If I'm preaching and I'm going full blast and all of a sudden I stop and I'm not saying anything, what will you do? You'll wake up to see what's going on, right? Have you ever been asleep at night and the power goes off? I have a noise machine that I can set to sound like waterfalls or rain. I carry that with me everywhere I go. Every meeting I go, I take my noise machine and my pillow. And I have the feeling of being at home. I have the same sound that I sleep by every night. The other night, I had that going. I usually put it on waterfalls. Or rain is, waterfalls is more constant than the rain. And by the way, this one that I've got now has on it where you can set it to sound like a human heartbeat. Who in the world would want to listen to a human heartbeat to make them sleep?
You put it in the baby's room.
Oh, you put that in the baby's room?
And it calms.
Well, I'm glad to know why it's on there. I knew it calms them. Okay. All right. Oh, it would. You'd be checking to see if it is that heartbeat or this heartbeat, wouldn't you? But the other night, about 2 o'clock in the morning, my power went off. And I awakened. It wasn't a sound. Now, you think a huge sound will awaken you, but what about silence? It will awaken you. I was wide awake, and I knew something was wrong. And for about 10 seconds, I couldn't figure out what it was. Then all of a sudden, I realized it, realized what it was. Now, I think that's the idea here. It may have been to get their attention, and then what Hazel said, I think, is definitely involved. The calm before the storm. If there's a tornado warning out, what usually happens just before it hits? A calm before the storm. And I'm going to tell you something else that I have noticed, and I don't think this is just me noticing it. I think it's a reality. I have noticed that most people, just before they die, seem to get better. There will be something, and I've seen this happen many, many times, where the person who maybe has almost been in a coma will tend to be able to know a few things, or has been in constant pain, seems like, and somebody will say, well, they appear to be better. I thought they were getting better. I've noticed that that happens many, many times. And I think that's the image here, that there's a calm before the storm. And part of that is in what's happened in chapter 7. He's saying, let me tell you these things to emphasize that God is still in charge. And I saw the seven angels which stood before God, and to them were given seven trumpets. Now this is what seal?
Seven.
But when it's opened, what's seen? The seven trumpets. So the seventh seal is sort of slides you into the seven trumpets. And it appears to me that if you look at this whole book as a scene, you see the seven seals suggesting destruction, and then you go into the seven trumpets. Does that seem to be a little worse? And then you go into the seven bowls of wrath, and that seems to be a little worse. I think he's saying it's going to get worse. And the idea of a fourth part and then a third part and then everybody affected carries that same idea too. And another angel came and stood at the altar, having a golden censer. There was given unto him much incense, that he should offer it with the prayers of all the saints unto the golden, upon the golden altar which was before the throne. This angel in verse 3 is not the angel in the verses above, not one of the seven angels. And he's not one of the four angels that's mentioned in verse 1 of chapter 7. This is an entirely different angel representing an entirely different thing. And he uses it, the idea of incense, but what does the incense represent? The prayers of the saints. What's he saying to the people to whom this is written? You suppose that they ever questioned whether or not their prayers were heard? What's he saying? Rest assured, God is aware of your prayers. And there's a lesson associated with this. Is there power in prayer?
Yes.
Certainly. This may be off the subject just a little bit, but I believe in divine healing. I don't believe in the Oral Roberts kind of divine healing where somebody can lay your hands on and heal somebody. But if I didn't believe that God could be involved in healing, I wouldn't pray and ask him for somebody to get better, would you? I don't believe that God works in miracles today like he did when Christ and the apostles were on earth. In fact, when Christ sent the message to John, said, go tell John that the blind see and the lame walk and the lepers are healed and so forth. And at that time, on one occasion, Jesus said, thy sins be forgiven thee, to the man that was lame. And they began to question what he was doing. He said, well, which is easier to say, thy sins be forgiven thee, or get up and walk? And he told him to get up and walk. And with Lazarus, what did he say? Come forth, and Lazarus came forth. Those were miracles. I don't believe that we have miracles today in that sense of instantaneous healing. But I believe God's hand is involved in everything. And are there things that happen sometimes with people that are sick that even the doctors cannot explain? Are there people whom the doctors will say cannot live over 2 weeks that get better and live for years? Hezekiah was told, set thine house in order, for thou shalt die and not live. And he prayed to God, and God lengthened his life, what? 15 years. Of course, that was back in a different age. But I believe that the hand of God is involved. He at least changed his mind on that occasion, didn't he? And that's not imperfection, because even the change of God's mind is perfection. But if we don't believe that God is involved in healing, we ought to quit praying for the sick. Does he work through doctors and nurses? I think so. Does he work through medicine? I think so. But frankly, I cannot explain everything that I've seen happen in life with doctors and nurses and medicine. I believe God's still in charge, that he has the ability. And we need to believe that our prayers are heard. Now, that doesn't mean that God's going to give us everything we ask for exactly like we ask for it. if the seven churches had been praying and God had said, tell me what you want today and I'll give it to you, what would they have asked for? Take care of all these problems when? Today. And sometimes God answers prayers not now. Sometimes he answers, I've got something better for you than what you're asking for. But this is a wonderful passage here, represented by the incense, offered with prayers of all saints upon the golden altar. Your prayers are being heard, is the idea that's here. And the smoke of the incense which came with the prayers of the saints ascended up before God out of the angel's hand. The angel took the censer and filled it with fire of the altar and cast it unto the earth. And there were voices and thunders and lightning and earthquake. Does that suggest that some of this that's happening is as a result of the prayers? The prayers are that things may be better. So the angel that offers up the prayers, or the incense here that represents the prayers, turns in the other direction. Now the first angel sounded. That's the first what? If he sounded, what was he blowing? That's the first trumpet. The seven trumpets are mentioned back in verse 2. Okay, the first angel sounded. There followed hail and fire mingled with blood, and they were cast upon the earth, and a third part of the trees were burned up. Second angel sounded. What did it affect? The sea became blood. Angel 1 affected the earth. Angel 2 affected the sea. Third part sounded, and the third angel sounded, there fell a great star from heaven, as it were burning, and it affected the rivers and the waters. The first, trees and the earth. The second, the seas. The third, the inner waterways. The name of the star was Wormwood, which means bitter. Fourth angel sounded, third part of the sun was smitten, third part of the moon. In other words, it affected at least the relationship to the heavenly bodies. Third part is mentioned in all of these. And I beheld and heard an angel flying through the midst of the heaven, saying with a loud voice, woe, woe, woe to the inhabitants of the earth by reason of the other voices of the trumpet of the three angels which are yet to sound. How many trumpets? How many are sounded in chapter 8? And he says there's three more. And what do you think is suggested by the idea of whoa, whoa, whoa?
More to come.
More to come, and possibly even worse than the four that I've described, right? There seems to be a progression involved. And then the fifth angel sounded in chapter 9. I saw a star fall from heaven upon the earth. To him was given the key to the bottomless pit, and he opened the bottomless pit, and there arose a smoke out of the pit as the smoke of a great furnace. And the sun and the air were darkened by reason of the smoke of the pit. Was that literal smoke? Let's read on. There came out of the smoke locusts upon the earth, and unto them was given power as the scorpions of the earth have power. Have you ever read about some of these instances where locusts have literally come in and taken all the vegetation and covered? And there are reports of those that report that there are so many of them that you can't even see the sun. In other words, it would be like what? Smoke covering the earth. The locusts were so thick. It was commanded them that they should not hurt the grass of the earth, neither any green thing, neither any tree, but only those men which have not the seal of God in their foreheads. What happened in chapter 7? He sealed whom? The saints. So who is it that doesn't have the seal in their foreheads? Those that are not the saints, those that are against the saints. To them was given that they should not kill them, but they should be tormented 5 months, and their torment was as the torment of a scorpion when he striketh the man. Have you ever heard anybody say, I wish I could go ahead and die? Is it possible that a person can be in such suffering that they'd rather die? Are there those who are going to be sentenced that sometimes would say, I'd rather they'd sentence me to death than to so many years in prison? I think this is the idea here, that they're going to be tormented. One lawyer, in defending a person and trying to keep him from being put, from having the death penalty, appealed to the judge and said, "Judge, I have heard several people in my lifetime pray to die, but I have never heard anybody pray to suffer." It's an unusual approach, an unusual point. But he was even saying, in pleading for this person's life, that giving him years of being incarcerated may be worse than death. And so he says, don't kill them, but they're going to be punished. The next few verses describe those scorpions. And the one thing I get out of that is that if this were literal, I certainly wouldn't want to meet them. And he uses several points in there to describe what the scorpions were like. I'd like to stop at that point and come back and begin at the first of the ninth chapter next week. Sort of read enough into it to get us started into that. That's the fifth seal that's there. You'll notice at verse 13, the sixth angel sounded. And then we're going to come down and have another interlude in the 10th chapter, in the first part of chapter 11, before we get to the last of this one. So we've covered the seals. Well, we're still in the seventh seal, looking at all the trumpets. And we're seeing the scene of God saying two things. Those that are persecuting the church are going to be dealt with, and those that are faithful are going to be protected. And that's basically, as far as I'm concerned, the lesson in the book of Revelation. Well, Terry, I didn't allow many people to talk much tonight, did I? Terry and I were talking before services tonight about how to involve people in classes. And it's hard in this book to involve people as much as I'd like to. Any thoughts or comments that you have? Yeah.
In James chapter 5, it mentions that God would have told us to pray for the sick, call the elders, and things like that. Yeah. Could be what he wants to heal
from. And in that same passage, he says, call for the elders and let them anoint them with oil. Yeah. And that brings up another discussion as to what that is.
I'll let you explain that to
me. Well, it may have been a ceremonial type anointing at that time, but it also could be referring to use of medicine.
That's what I think from the
yeah. And I think at least that principle is there today, that if you call for elders of the church to come and pray for you when you're sick, they're not going to tell you, well, you throw away your medicine and we'll pray for you. But I think it at least suggests that. But go ahead. Yeah, I would do that, or I would suggest to them, well, I believe somewhat like you do that God was involved in this. I don't believe it was a miracle in the sense of instantaneous healing, but I do believe that God was involved. And if I couldn't get the point across, then I would get mean. And I'd say, well, then if that happened, then the one that died, was that God's fault? We've got to be careful how far we go. I knew of one little girl that came very depressed because a friend of hers was killed in an automobile accident. She blamed herself. She said, I forgot to pray for their safety that day, and if I'd prayed for their safety, God would have answered it. And we can take these points to the nth degree and get into some problems. And I think the answer to much of what we're saying is this, and think about this. There are things that I strongly believe about the power of God that I cannot explain the details of. I believe very strongly in God's providence. And sometimes I think in hindsight, I think I can see some of the ways that his providence worked. But we need to be extremely careful when we start trying to explain the mind of God. That's where faith comes in. And some of these things, we can believe that God is in charge, that he has the power to do these, and that he's involved in all these things that happen. But when we start trying to explain this thing that happened was because God loved this person, and this thing happened because he didn't love him as much, and we can get into some extremely deep situations there.